The 1992 Los Angeles uprising, the Cambodian genocide, Japanese-American incarceration. What you know isn't always the full story. Our new podcast, Inheriting, about Asian American and Pacific Islander families where the past is personal.
Korean Americans, we call it sa-i-gu.
Did you ever realize when you were a child that you became an orphan?
Camp was such a hard time. How do you think you got through it?
Listen to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
A synagogue, a police station, and two Orthodox churches all came under attack in southern Russia.
The feeling that Russia's security apparatus has failed yet again in this case is becoming much more present.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, after the Hajj, the death toll climbs. Travelers without special visas fell victim to the scorching heat.
They're not going to have access to, you know, the buses and the tents.
In Istanbul, we take you to a cafe that brings Arabic-speaking refugees together.
It's kind of this underground, deep place that a lot of communities need it.
Plus, a withering grape harvest in Spain could mean a dry spell everywhere for lovers of Spanish bubbly.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it here today. Carnage in southern Russia last night. Several gunmen opened fire, killing at least 20 people in Dagestan. Dozens more were injured and taken to local hospitals. Russian authorities are calling it a coordinated attack. The targets were a synagogue, a police station, and two churches. The World's Daniel Hoffman has been following the developing story from his base in Riga, Latvia. What is the latest on this attack, Daniel, and what else do we know at this point?
So there are a few more details that have come out today. Russian state news organizations are reporting that five gunmen are now dead. We still don't know the exact circumstances of their deaths. As you mentioned, Russian officials are calling it a coordinated attack. Of course, religious buildings were targeted, a synagogue was set on fire, and reportedly an Orthodox priest was among those killed. We also know that there were attacks in two separate cities. There was an attack on a church and a synagogue in Derbent, and another attack in Makhachkala on another church and a police post near a synagogue there. But there's some basic information that we can't verify yet. We still don't know the identities of the shooters, and we don't know their motives. And we also don't know who planned these attacks or whether these shooters were affiliated with a larger organization.
Daniel, just remind us where Dagestan is and what's important to know about the region.
Yeah, so Dagestan is a majority Muslim region in southern Russia. It's in the northern Caucasus, and it borders Chechnya, another region that often comes up in the news because of the repressive leadership of Ramzan Kadyrov. The two cities that I mentioned where these attacks took place are Makhachkala, that's the regional capital of Dagestan, and Derbent. They're about 75 miles apart, and they both sit on the banks of the Caspian Sea, which is the world's largest lake. Dagestan and the northern Caucasus in general have a history of separatism and violence, and that's something that the Kremlin has tried to keep in check, but has often failed to do so.
Over the last year or so, we've seen a few different high-profile attacks in Russia. How does this attack in Dagestan fit within that context?
Marco, there are two noteworthy attacks worth mentioning here. The first happened last October when a violent mob stormed the Makhachkala International Airport in Dagestan. A rumor spread in social media in Makhachkala that a plane full of Jewish refugees from Israel was on its way to Dagestan. A mob stormed the airport looking for Jews. They didn't find any, but they caused great damage to the airport. The other recent event, which happened in March, was the Krokus City Hall concert shooting. That attack left 147 people dead, and it's one of the deadliest attacks in modern Russian history. And an ISIS affiliate, a group called ISIS-K, claimed responsibility for that attack. As for the shooting in Dagestan yesterday, no groups or individuals have yet claimed responsibility.
Given these various attacks, including the one that just took place in Dagestan yesterday, Daniel, what is there to say about the Kremlin's ability to protect Russian citizens, especially as the Kremlin is waging a grinding war in Ukraine?
So what you just said, that right there is a problem for the Kremlin right now, because Russian President Vladimir Putin, he's been in power in Russia for more than 24 years. And one of his biggest selling points that he and his supporters often repeat is that Putin equals security and stability. Well, we're now seeing multiple cases over the course of this year where Russian citizens can seriously doubt the Kremlin's ability to provide that kind of security and stability. So the feeling that Russia's security apparatus has failed yet again in this case is becoming much more present.
Got it. So what is the Kremlin actually saying? Has Putin commented on this attack in Dagestan?
Putin hasn't, and he usually doesn't comment this quickly. After the Krokus shooting, it took more than 24 hours before he made a public statement. And in this case, we're seeing a lot of messages coming from other Russian officials that are similar to some of the comments we saw after the Krokus shooting in Moscow. So Russian authorities are saying that the situation is under control and that they've launched an investigation. But even though the investigation is in its early stages, some officials are already floating conspiracy theories that Ukraine was somehow behind this attack or that the West orchestrated it. So the same thing also happened after the Krokus shooting in March. Now, we did hear from Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov. He said that President Putin offered his condolences. But again, we didn't hear directly from Putin. Mm. And one explanation for that is the Kremlin's desire to distance Putin from this clear-cut security failure.
The World's Daniel Hoffman speaking with us from Riga, the Latvian capital, with the latest on the deadly attacks that took place yesterday in Dagestan in southern Russia. Daniel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
A lot of refugees live in Istanbul after fleeing political persecution in Syria, Afghanistan, and North Africa, around 500,000 by some estimates. Members of that refugee community have created their own safe spaces, even as anti-foreigner sentiment is on the rise. In the historic Balat neighborhood, there's a Syrian-run art center and cafe where people who speak Arabic can meet up and connect. The World's Jerry Buscarin takes us there.
Meet the Refugee Guitars Orchestra. With long dark hair and fingers the speed of light, Omar Al-Kilani leads a band practice in the basement stage of the YOLO Art Center. YOLO for You Only Live Once. As he does a quick sound check, he tells me he's Syrian, basically.
Basically? Why basically?
Since I've been living here, like, for 11 years, so... And I'm 25 years old, so it's been like, am I Turkish or am I Syrian? I don't really know.
Like many young people who grew up in Turkey as the Syrian civil war raged across the border, Al-Kilani usually feels like he's somewhere between both worlds. He speaks Arabic at home, Turkish in the street, but the YOLO Art Center is a refuge.
It's kind of this underground, deep place that a lot of communities needed.
The stage gives non-Turkish artists in Istanbul a performance space and an audience hungry for live events in Arabic. And it gives people living far from home a chance to make friends. The YOLO Art Center is the brainchild of Bayan Agha, a trained architect from Aleppo who shifted careers when she couldn't get a Turkish work permit.
Unfortunately, Istanbul is a huge city. There's a lot of nationalities, but a very, very, very few art centers, especially in Arabic.
So Alha decided to make her own. On a weeknight, there's a movie night happening on the top floor, while Al-Kilani's band practices in the basement. On the main floor, a crowd gathers in the cafe for a salon-style performance of visiting Tunisian vocalist Amal Ben Amour. Agha advertises each event on Instagram, from an earthquake awareness training to stand-up comedy, board game nights and drawing classes, group meals on holidays. Recently, she organized a small tour, bringing Arabic artists to venues in smaller cities in Turkey.
And they were like, thank you for remembering us. We really appreciate that. No one is talking to us. No one is like talking like we are existed. And this is the first time we've ever like heard anything in Arabic live or an Arab musician they are playing in front of us.
She says her mission is to bring people together without geopolitics, religion, or national borders to distract them.
Like, the world is coming more open
Yeah. The center recently ran into financial difficulties, and Aha isn't sure it can stay open past August. She started a GoFundMe in a last-ditch effort. Visitors mingle during an intermission over cups of tea and coffee the Yemeni way, flavored with cardamom and condensed milk.
We come to here without our friends or our families.
Sara Dehile lived in Syria, Lebanon, and Algeria before settling in Turkey 9 years ago. She says she often comes to post up at the cafe with her laptop, getting work done. Other times, she comes for music nights.
And when we came to here, we forget our lonely times.
It's like a family, she says. For The World, I'm Dari Biskarin, Istanbul.
Today is Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals, pitting the Edmonton Oilers against the Florida Panthers in their final faceoff. The Oilers came back after losing the first three games in the series to tie it up. The only time a team has done that and won the whole thing was in 1942 when the Toronto Maple Leafs were victorious. Edmonton could do the same thing this year. The team would also be breaking a 31-year Stanley Cup drought for Canadian teams in the National Hockey League. For more, we reached out to the Toronto Stars' Kevin McGran. Kevin, this is quite the feat that the Oilers have pulled off. Edmonton fans must be through the roof right now, right?
Well, it really is quite remarkable. I mean, they were left for dead after game three. Nobody comes back from down three in a seven-game series. It had been tried before. Like you said, the only team that ever did it was all the way back in 1942, the Toronto Maple Leafs, and the game was very different back then. Like only, you know, fewer players and slightly different rules and all these sorts of things.
And now they are heading into the decisive game. If they win, this would be the first time that a Canadian team would take home the Stanley Cup in 31 years. So what is the national mood heading into this game? Is the whole country behind them?
Not a chance. The whole country's behind it. It's like hockey's a passion here. I mean, the we call it the Stanley Cup. Its actual name is the Dominion of Canada Challenge Cup. That's what's actually engraved on the bowl.
Huh.
That was when it was donated in the 19th century. It was for the best team in Canada. The rules around it have all changed. The NHL controls it now. But Canadians are embedded with their team and nobody else. I'm in Toronto. Toronto fans, I cover the Maple Leafs. They would rather another Canadian team lose than a Canadian team win the Stanley Cup. I think some people have gotten on board with the Oilers. I mean, I do know some Leaf fans that are rooting for the Oilers, but I don't think they're really rooting for the Oilers as such. But they are rooting for Connor McDavid, so that when we go into bars and argue about who the greatest player ever is, you can throw Connor McDavid's name into it because we're witnessing something special with that player, very Gretzky-like.
Yeah, let's talk more about Connor McDavid. A big reason why the Oilers have racked up a mind-boggling 18 goals in the past three games is down to him. Tell me more about just how good he is.
Well, he is a unique player in many ways. I mean, McDavid is the fastest player in the league. He does so many things at such high speed. His hockey IQ, the game happens really, really quickly, and he knows what to do with the puck long before he gets it. The thing with Gretzky was always, don't go where the puck is, go where the puck is going. And McDavid is one of those guys who doesn't see what's in front of him. He sees what's ahead of him, and he just knows what to do. I mean, there was a goal the other night where he went through four players. He drew all four players and the goalie to him, and then he passed to Corey Perry for an easy goal.
So despite what you've told me about tribalism in Canadian hockey, do you think if the Edmonton Oilers pull this out tonight that the whole country will be celebrating tomorrow?
No. Pockets of it will. I mean, the Oilers have won over some fans, that's for sure. And there are fans of every team in every city. Like that, you know, there are Oilers fans that have always been Oilers fans in Toronto, that's for sure. But the one thing they'll be relieved about, they'll probably all be unanimous in being relieved that narrative is over, that a Canadian team has finally won the Stanley Cup again. So they'll be happy with that. And apparently Boston Pizza is like going to throw a big pizza party across the country. So they might get some free pizza or something like that.
Kevin McGran is a sports writer for the Toronto Star. Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals is tonight. You are listening to The World.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. They are getting medieval behind closed doors at more than 100 German-speaking universities in Europe. That's where you'll find a secretive, highly controversial tradition that continues today, a form of sword fighting with real blades. It's known as Mensur, and for some, it's central to their idea of masculinity and honor in modern Europe. Reporter Leah Hornack was given unusual access to one group of fighters.
So if I sit here and one of you sits here and here,
yeah,
I can sit in the middle. That seems good, yeah.
This interview has already started awkwardly. Everyone is stiffly formal, politely watching me set up my microphones.
Strange to listen to myself speaking in English afterwards.
We're in a spotlessly tidy rec room at an all-male university fraternity, a frat, somewhere in Germany. The fraternity brothers in the room have asked me not to reveal their names or the name of the frat, or even the city we're in. Students at this kind of fraternity generally don't trust the modern media. They're aware of the legal grey area that their sport sometimes exists in. But then the mood changes when they bring out the photos.
So this one was mine, which was immediately after the match was finished.
The frat brother opposite me, let's call him by the initial F, is holding up his phone with a photo on it. But at first, I can't quite work out what I'm looking at.
I was struck quite unluckily on the head.
And then it clicks. It's him covered in blood. And I have to say something.
Yeah, it's actually quite the artistic photo.
Okay, not artistic. It's a horror show. What strikes me as someone who sees this is basically the whole photo is red with blood.
Good look it's, at it it's, that way.
This is a photo of your face, and beneath your eyes, downwards, there's just rivers of blood, basically.
As you can hear, F is laughing. And in the photo itself, he's also grinning through the gore. He looks overjoyed. To be a member of this frat, everyone must take part in a unique sport, the ancient art of Mensur, or sword fighting with real sharpened blades. And this photo is the normal result of a match. 10 stitches to the scalp, sewn up without anaesthetic, as per the tradition.
So, I mean, it looks like someone has thrown half a bottle of red wine in your face.
At some points, it certainly felt like that.
F's best friend and frat brother, we'll call him by the initial M, has similar photos and sword marks still on his body.
And actually, took a blow last time to the head.
I can see just above your eye there is a scar about 1.5 inches, 2 inches long.
Sitting in front of me without the blood, F and M are both clean cut and preppy. Chinos, hair parted sharply to the side. They could be finance bros on a weekend off or recent military recruits on leave from boot camp. But Mensur is at the centre of their lives. And in a few months' time, they'll be going into battle again. They've both been challenged to a Mensur against a pair of more experienced opponents from another fraternity. They know they're the underdogs, and they're now ramping up their training.
Especially when you risk your head, literally, then it's always helpful to train hard. Well, we have a saying in Mensur, Schweiß spart Blut, which translates into sweat saves you blood.
In a Mensur bout, the tip of the sword is not used, only the razor-sharp edge. You slice your opponent, not stab him. Only the head, not the body, is considered a valid target. Traditionally, you wear small metal goggles and a sort of metal beak to protect your eyes and nose. But the rest of your face and scalp is exposed and open to the blade. Serious injury from Mensur is rare, but the risk of scarring and permanent facial disfigurement is real.
So obviously the question arises, why do something like that? It's a sport, it's an extreme sport. Other people jump out of airplanes or do base jumping. And yeah, the way I've always viewed it is as a testing myself. And the mental aspect of it is the most important part.
That's one version I've heard a lot. Mensur as another character-building adrenaline sport. But there's another side that sets it apart from skydiving or boxing. and it gets to a side of Mansour that's harder to reconcile with. When M and F go into their next fight, there will be more riding on it than just the match.
In our fraternity, if someone runs away from a Mansour, it's for us clear he's not someone for us, so we, kick him out. It's never an option to run away from a Mansour.
If you back out of a fight or break the rules in a serious way, you can be thrown out of the fraternity, turned out of your accommodation and ostracized by the whole community. An outcast. Unmanly. So when M and F received their latest challenge to fight, it would have been more than shameful to turn it down. It would have been social death. Maybe that's why they're grinning in the bloody post-match photos. They know they've proved themselves, made the grade.
Fertig.
Los!
At the frat's daily Mansour training session, the frat brothers spar intensely against each other. Steel against steel, echoing round the room, repeating and perfecting set attacks and routines. It's a scene that feels unchanged for centuries. Mansour is controversial for one more reason, though. Its connection to the far right. The sport was banned by the Nazis. Hitler preferred boxing. But in modern times, there have been well-documented examples of far-right activity at Mansour practicing fraternities. In 2018, a song celebrating the Holocaust was found in the official songbook of a Mansour fraternity in Austria. M and F assure me that they reject prejudice and political extremism, and they said there's a range of political views amongst their fraternity members. They did say that students joining tend to lean conservative, however. Many liberal Germans and Austrians are less sympathetic. For them, Mansour is part of their country's past they'd like to leave behind.
Hey, Leo, can you hear us?
A few months after our first meeting, I speak to M and F via Zoom. They've made it through their big fight with honour.
All in all, the only one who had to be stitched at all was me. And that was really just a scratch.
Merely a flesh wound, of course. F says it's probably his last fight. His girlfriend's asked him to quit.
So if I follow her advice, then I'm about to retire, but you never know.
M is more doubtful.
I have a short fuse, so it's more probable that I will do another one, but one day you have to put your weapons down.
In fact, since this call, M has fought again. A student from another frat acted disrespectfully at a party, and M challenged him to a Mansour. And that's how the rules work. Because it's forbidden for anyone to refuse a challenge to fight, not without leaving their frat, no one can be sure when or if they will retire. It would be unmanly, un-Mansour-like, to promise anything else. For the world, I'm Leo Hornack, Germany.
Leo is reporting there referenced far-right political ideologies in Europe. Find our extensive reporting on shifting politics across the continent online at theworld.org and wherever you listen to podcasts. More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. In Casablanca, a traditional style of music is being injected with new life, in part thanks to the women picking up a genre that used to be just for men.
It was for me the first time I see a girl playing the djembe like the men. You are amazed the first time.
The story of two sisters bringing Kanawa to new audiences ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Islam, the five-day Hajj is a religious requirement and a spiritual journey. But this year, when temperatures in Mecca soared past 124 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 1,300 people died, according to Saudi officials. Faisal Cuddy teaches at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles and has written extensively about the Hajj. He says pilgrims coming to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj through unofficial channels are the people who face the most risk.
Typically, if you're a registered Haji, then the government does provide air-conditioned tents to everyone and also air-conditioned buses. But I think in this case here, from what we understand, there were a lot of tour operators sending people there without registration. And so they wouldn't have access to those air-conditioned tents or buses. And from what I understand, there was approximately 400,000 people, according to Saudi government statements, that were actually unregistered.
How does a pilgrim to Mecca actually get registered? Is it happening through those tour operators or some other means?
In the past, you know, the only way to go to Saudi Arabia was with a Hajj visa or an Umrah visa and possibly maybe business visa. But now, since Saudi has become more open, there's tourist visas and visitor visas are being issued. And the understanding is they're just touring the country. They're not participating in this very strenuous pilgrimage, right? They won't have buses, so they're walking. For your listeners, Hajj entails a lot of walking. We're talking about if you don't have a bus, then you're talking about miles. So, you know, on the first day, after you do 7 times around the Kaaba, which is that black cubic structure, 7 times counterclockwise, the distance just around that Kaaba could be very short if you're very close to the Kaaba. But if you're one of the 2 million who are on the outside, you could be walking miles there. Okay. Then you do 5 miles from there to Mina on the same day. Okay. And you also have to do before that 7 times Safa and Marwa, the 2 mountains. So you're walking there, and those are great distances. Then after that, you have another 7 miles.
That is a lot of walking in a lot of heat. Official registration, though, sounds like it doesn't necessarily entail care. It just gets you into Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. Is that correct?
Exactly. You kind of are sneaking in, or you're sneaking in using another visa, which I think the Saudi government and other jurisdictions are going to have to police and see what happened here and what fell through the cracks. And I think some of the Muslim countries where a large number of deaths were suffered, people have been fired. There's investigations launched in Egypt. A large number of tour operators have been suspended because they may have offered people, hey, we can take you there. You don't need to get a Hajj visa necessarily. You can come here as a visitor. Okay, you know, the Hajj visa, you have to apply. There's quotas from each country, etc. Well, let's just work around it. Let's just apply for a visitor visa. We'll just pretend that we're going for visiting Saudi. And then once you get in there, then we'll just sneak in and do the Hajj, right? And then a certain number of deaths is going to be inevitable because you have 2 million people gathering in the heat. And, you know, the rules of Hajj is if you're not financially in a position to do so, or if you're not physically, health-wise, in a position to do so, you shouldn't be doing it. But unfortunately, a lot of the people who are doing the Hajj, or many of the people who are doing it, they're not in the best of health. But, you know, for them, it's a spiritual thing. And they're like, you know, I need to do this and I have to do this. And so they do it.
I wanted to ask you about the economic pressure to do the Hajj. You mentioned, as we said, many of those who perished were from Egypt. Egypt's currency is in free fall. And there were many pilgrims who've been saving for decades to travel to Mecca. They decided they just couldn't wait any longer. Did currency fluctuations and just sheer inflation play a role?
Especially people from the developing world, they're saving for their entire life. They actually, you'll see some bank accounts in Muslim countries will have, you know, savings account for my house, savings account for my car, saving account for my Hajj. Right? That they save their entire life to do this. And so I think what's necessary here is the religious leadership needs to step up and basically remind people, God is a forgiving God, and you don't need to necessarily put your life in jeopardy, right? I mean, God will understand, right? I mean, I think maybe the religious leadership need to really communicate with people who are in these kind of dire straits, and they're stretching their financial limits, but also from a health perspective. There's other ways that you can seek forgiveness from God. You don't necessarily need to do this.
Faisal Qadi, he teaches at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles.
Some rain in Spain is bringing relief after years of drought, but so far it's not enough to save struggling crops, like the grapes used to make cava. Cava is a sparkling wine, kind of like champagne, but distinctly Spanish. In the northeast region of Catalonia, where most cava is made, it flows at dinner parties and weddings. But the dry spell has withered vineyards. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Sant Sadurní d'Anoia.
In cava country, the grapevines are parched. Many of the trunks as dry and hollow-sounding as driftwood. This one's already dead. Its ash-gray bark cracks and falls off at the touch. One out of 3 grapevines in this region has perished since the drought started in 2020. It's been especially devastating for cava vintners because they're not allowed to water their grapes.
El cava tiene un código. Unas bases, unos estatutos.
To produce cava, explains local vineyard worker Antonio Dominguez, irrigating is forbidden. The grapes must depend solely on rainfall. Otherwise, he says, we'd lose our denomination of origin. We'd be making just another sparkling wine. It has rained some in recent weeks, but it's not nearly enough for the cava grapevine, says Dominguez.
La planta más veterana, más vieja de la viña, que puede llegar a vivir entre 30 y 40 años.
The oldest grapevines here are 30 or 40 years old with really deep roots, he says. The bit of rain that's fallen isn't reaching and replenishing the subsoil. It stays on the surface. Dominguez has been working the Cava vineyards for 40 years. He says he's never seen a crisis like this, nor such desperate measures, he says, to salvage the vines.
Ya de los brotes, de los dos brotes que tiene la planta, igual cortan uno para que viva el otro.
Of the two branches that each grapevine has, he says, we're amputating one so that the other can survive and produce grapes. Dominguez works for Cava producer Freixenet. Freixenet exports its sparkling beverage all over the world, including to the U.S. Company executives declined interview requests, but with production off by around 40% this year, the firm has furloughed some 600 employees, including Dominguez. The knock-on effects of the crisis are rippling across the Cava villages of this region called the Penedès.
La mayoría de cavas han subido el precio, tanto son bodegas más pequeñas como más grandes.
At a cava shop called Gusta Pobla in San Sadurní, owner Guillaume Tena says fewer grapes have created a cava shortage, which has driven prices up. He says local shoppers now hesitate before buying. All told, Catalunya's cava vineyards cover about 100,000 acres. People in nearby villages are deeply worried because cava isn't just something you sip with lunch. It's inseparable from their history and identity. In San Sadurní, there's an interactive museum dedicated to the drink. Some fun facts you learn here. When cava was invented in the late 19th century, so was its standard 3/4 liter bottle, because back then that was the recommended daily allowance for wine, about 6 glasses per person.
En muchos deportes, los ganadores celebran su triunfo agitando una enorme botella de champán.
And you know how after sporting victories everyone sprays cava or champagne on everyone else? That dates back to a Peking to Paris car rally in 1907. The winner, an Italian prince named Scipione Borghese, who spontaneously soaked his pals with the bubbly. Never mind that Borghese's chauffeur had done most of the driving. But the highlight of the Cava Museum, a tiny yellow sap-sucking insect called Phylloxera. The pest inadvertently arrived in Europe in the 1850s by boat in a shipment of plants from the U.S., explains museum guide Laia Altisen.
En los primeros 5 años, cuando llegó la filoxera en el 1887...
Within 5 years, the filoxera wiped out 90% of our vineyards, she says. Today, during our yearly town fiestas, we celebrate our victory over the plague and the fact that we can still make a living off of cava. At said fiesta, townsfolk dress up as the yellow invader and swarm bug-like through the streets, shooting off fireworks and dancing. The U.S. was indeed the source of the plague, but it also provided the solution. American grapevines were mostly resistant to phylloxera. Europe was able to save its remaining grapevines by grafting them onto imported Yankee rootstocks. But this latest drought, worsened by climate change, experts say, is a tougher enemy. Vineyard worker Antonio Dominguez says he and hundreds of furloughed Freixenet employees have had their hours slashed and are living off partial salaries and government support. But that's only until the end of the year, when the furlough deal expires.
Lo hemos complementado bien, salarialmente, entendemos, pero nos preocupa el futuro también.
We're okay for now in terms of our wages, he says, but what will happen to us in January or February and beyond? Even if the rains return to normal, Dominguez says, it'll be at least a couple of harvests before the ground is saturated enough for the vineyards to bounce back. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, San Sadurní d'Anoia, Spain.
And now a few updates on stories we've been covering recently on The World.
Tumaj Salehi is an Iranian rapper we've profiled, a high-profile critic of Iran's government. He had been sentenced to death for his anti-government songs and protests. This weekend, his lawyer announced his death sentence was overturned by the country's Supreme Court.
The European Union may be softening its position on electric vehicles from China. The EU had imposed high tariffs on EV imports from China earlier this month. Now, officials from China and the EU say they're open to negotiations over EVs.
And in Mexico, the USDA says it will gradually restart inspections of avocados and mangoes, a food safety requirement that was suspended last week after attacks on inspectors. Drug cartels are accused of infiltrating Mexico's avocado industry. U.S. Ambassador Ken Salazar says the U.S. still needs more assurances for the inspector's safety.
You can find more reporting on those stories online at theworld.org.
In Morocco, there's a traditional kind of music known as ganawa, a sound that has been identified as a precursor to the American blues. It emerged among sub-Saharan Africans who were enslaved and brought to Morocco centuries ago. Ganawa has been getting attention for several years outside of Morocco, and now, again, thanks to two sisters shaking up what used to be a strictly male art form. Reporter Alexa Dvorsen met up with them in Casablanca as they prepared for a European tour.
Asma Hamzawi was 6 years old when she knew she wanted to play the gimbri, the box-shaped three-stringed lute that forms the basis of Ganawa music. I was born into this musical backdrop, she says. I took in the emotions of Ganawa with my mother's milk. So in this kind of family, it's already confirmed that you're a Ganawia, a person who plays this music. And I'm the first woman to do this. Ganawa is always used for telling stories about real people, Asma explains. This is spiritual music. Ganawa is pure emotion. It brings everyone together like family. And this particular family has only daughters. So although this musical inheritance goes against tradition, it made sense for them to learn Ganawa with the blessings of their parents. Asma's sister Aisha plays the kraket, the large double-plated iron castanets. Legend has it that this instrument was fashioned from the neck shackles forced upon the enslaved.
Ganawa?
Asma Hamzawi and Banat Timbuktu, the name of the five-woman group, released their second album in May, produced in Sweden. It's titled Banat, which means girls in Moroccan Arabic. That's Rashid Hamzawi, the father of Asma and Aisha. Why shouldn't women play this music? He asks. I've always been at peace about it. If your family is involved, it's only natural. We need more Ganawa masters, more competence.
You can sit, I will just bring tea.
Khalil Munji, a communication specialist in health and science, spends much of his free time promoting Ganawa culture, which he likens to a virus.
When it hits you the first time, you can't get rid of it.
So you're one of the people with this virus?
Of course.
He remembers the first time he saw Asma Hamzawi perform.
She played in Casablanca, and it was for me the first time I see a girl playing the gimbri like the men. You are amazed the first time. And then I suggest to her to do a video. She accepted. Then
soon after Khalil helped her get noticed on social media, invitations poured in. Asma and her group have since played in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. This summer, they're promoting their new album in Italy, Hungary, and Germany. The roots of Ganawa's commercial appeal lie in the ancient healing rituals, or lilas, that are still practiced today. These dusk-to-dawn gatherings begin with songs that retell the story of Black African slavery in Morocco, with prayers for liberation. Whoever comes for healing is later invited to join in dancing until they fall into a trance. Khalil recalls the effect this music had on him years ago.
It was strange. Today I know that it's the magic of the sound of the gimbri. and the crack helps to bring people in trance, but also to unite people, because the Gnawa music is universal music. A lot of people don't understand what it's talking about, but the first time they experience something like this, they are all dancing and singing the same lyrics.
Khalil Munji believes this also fills a human need. The curious thing about trance, according to some teachers, is that our everyday lives are already a kind of trance of the ego, and the only way to be grounded in a deeper nature of reality is to enter an even deeper trance. The trance state brought about in Gnawa music is all about freedom. A mysteriously hypnotic instrument, the gimbri is made of rosewood and camel skin, with strings made from the gut of a goat. Asma Hamzawi started traveling with the gimbri at the age of 15. Today, at 26, she's defiant toward anyone who says she shouldn't be a Gnawi. Go ahead and criticize me, she says. While you're doing that, I'm out there working. I say this every day. At first, it was Gnawa musicians who questioned me, but I'm here as a woman, and that's that. I'm proud of myself, she adds. Asma's sister Aisha sums up the main message of their new album.
Gnawa music, women now in the world.
Watch out, world, here come Moroccan women.
Yes.
For the world, I'm Alexa Divorson, Casablanca.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Afghanistan, the ruling Taliban has banned girls and women from education, work, and even some public spaces. Zalik Wahid was a first-year medical student in Kabul when she had to flee the country and leave behind her dream of becoming a doctor. Now in the U.S., she's trying to achieve those dreams once again. Here she is telling her story with the storytelling project Stories from the Stage.
I have never met my grandfather, but growing up in Afghanistan, I remember listening to stories about his passion to medicine and how an amazing doctor he was. He was very famous for having a good hand and making his patients feel comfortable despite the limited medical equipment and resources. When I was at grade 11, I had this amazing English teacher. She was the kind of person who was able to tell you how good you are. One day she said to me, I'm seeing a wonderful doctor in your face. Could she see my grandfather in my face? But in another way, it really encouraged me. And from then on, I decided to become a doctor. I was born in 2001, the same year that Taliban left the government in Afghanistan. With them being out of power, this means that I grew up in an era where girls were able to get an education. Although the security situation of Afghanistan was never completely stable, there were often events of suicide bombers and attacks, and there were never enough surgeons to care for patients and the injured ones. And there were never enough women doctors. I remember telling my mom, I want to help. 2 years later, on 2020, I'm a first-year medical student at Kabul University of Medical Sciences. I'm one of the 70 women among 150 classmates in my class. This is an amazing time for me and for my family, and we are seeing a good future for myself. I love the studying, going to cafes, and attending labs until the Taliban attacked our university on November of 2020. I was at school that day, and I heard the explosion and the screaming of the students. Our teacher told us to run. Because our campus was surrounded with the large walls, we had to climb the ladders over the razor wire to jump to safety. It was the scariest moment of my life. This event frightened my family, and they asked me that I have to apply for a scholarship to go outside the country and continue my medical studies, since the Taliban are being known for preventing girls from going to school and forcing them into marriages. I told my family I would apply just to make them feel happy. However, in my mind, we are living in 21st century. This will never happen. We have freedom in Afghanistan, despite the attacks. But I was wrong that day. On August 15, 2021, we learned that the Taliban took over the government. My father, who worked with the United Nations for almost 20 years, which put him at risk. Earlier that evening, a cousin who lived near the airport has told us about the evacuation flights. My dad and my brother went to investigate. When it seemed possible, my dad sent my brother home to get us. Honestly, leaving Afghanistan seemed so impossible. I didn't even pack a bag, and my mother, who is 8 months pregnant, stayed behind. She said it would be difficult in her condition to travel, but I think she didn't believe we would actually get out. If we had known, I would have begged my mom to come, but everything was happening so quickly. I remember my body being pushed onto the flight with hundreds of other people. 2 weeks later, we arrived in the United States, in Virginia, at a military base. This is my first time traveling out of Afghanistan. At registration, they put a bracelet with our names around our wrists. And at this point, the officers told us that we cannot stay together since man and woman are being segregated. I look at my father and I realize I have never been alone without my family. As my father and I say goodbye, both of us start crying. I am assigned to live in a big hall of 70 other women and children, mostly from rural areas of Afghanistan and more conservative families. I feel alone. I feel alone because I'm the only single woman in the room and I'm not fluent in their language, which was Pashto language. For the first week, I'm sitting in my bunk bed, crying all the time, not eating food, and I can only see my dad and my brother outside during the day. There is no good internet connection to reach my mom. I felt like everything that I had worked for is ending. However, I tried to not give up on my dream of becoming a doctor, even though I didn't know how it would be possible. I learned that there were medical tents in the base where staff were treating patients. One day, I went there and I asked, can I volunteer as an interpreter? I told them I can speak English. And they said to me, sorry, we don't need your help. We have interpreters. And I kept going back because that was the only thing in my power that I could do at that time. I wanted to learn about the United States medical system. Eventually, they let me help, and I start asking questions about what does it look like to become a doctor in the United States, and they would tell me about their journeys. This made me very hopeful again. Working at the tents also helped me to get up from my bed and to not be overwhelmed all the time by the anxiety and stress of what I left behind. 4 months later, we moved to Massachusetts. And this is the time when everything starts to get real. As we start to build a new life from scratch, whereas we were provided shelter in the base. And everything is very expensive. I also started to worry about my dream of becoming a doctor. Some people say to me, you have to give up on your dream. Medical school is very expensive in the United States. But my father tells me to not give up on your dream. He said he would work 2 or 3 jobs if he has to support me to get back into medical school. So from there, I decided no matter how many challenges I faced and I will face, I will become a doctor somehow. I want to make my father proud and my mother, who said to me, you must go to the airport. And I also want to honor all the female classmates who were unable to get out of Afghanistan, and now they are stuck at home and they cannot continue their education. I want to give women hope everywhere. Thank you.
Zalik Waheed there sharing her experience with stories from the stage from our GBH partners at World TV.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.